Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're plunging into one of humanity's most enduring and, frankly, pretty mind-bending questions. Do we truly have free will?
It's a huge one, isn't it?
Absolutely. Are our choices genuinely our own? Or are we, you know, just following a script, maybe written by fate, physics, or even our own unconscious?
Right. Where does our feeling of freedom come from?
We're exploring this whole philosophical landscape through a really remarkable book, Free Will, which is a comprehensive anthology edited by the late great philosopher Robert Kane.
A fantastic collection.
Our mission today is to sort of map out this intricate debate for you. Not just to understand the arguments, but to really grasp what's at stake in your own life.
And it truly is personal. Every decision, you know, from what you have for breakfast to some massive life choice, it feels like a free act.
That feeling is so strong.
But what if that feeling is, well, maybe partly an illusion, or at least more complicated? What's striking is that this isn't just some dusty academic puzzle.
No, not at all.
Understanding the free will debate, it really impacts how you think about moral responsibility, our justice system, personal growth, relationships.
Even our sense of purpose, right? Achievement.
Exactly. So hopefully this deep dive will equip you to navigate your own life and society with maybe a bit more thought and nuance.
That's a crucial point. And guiding us through this intellectual terrain is Robert Kane himself.
Mm-hmm.
He sadly passed away just recently in 2024.
A real giant in the field.
He was more than just the editor of this incredible volume. He was a central, active participant in the free will debate for decades.
Absolutely. He was a University Distinguished Teaching Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at UT Austin, PhD from Yale. But what makes his perspective so distinctive and why he was perfect to curate this collection is that he wasn't neutral.
He had skin in the game.
He really did. He was a leading proponent, maybe even an architect, of a specific view called libertarian free will. He's famous for his concept of self-forming actions, or SFAs.
Self-forming actions?
Yeah.
That sounds powerful. Like, we actually forge ourselves.
That's the idea. He deeply believed in that capacity. And because he was so involved, he had this unparalleled insider's view. He knew all the arguments, inside and out.
From actually debating them.
Right. But despite his own strong convictions, he was hugely respected for his scholarly rigor and fairness as an editor. He didn't just push his own view.
No, he gave everyone a fair hearing.
He really did. The collection gives a powerful voice to his intellectual opponents, to compatibilists, hard determinists. He wrote landmark books himself, like The Significance of Free Will. He just, he understood the entire battlefield, as the outline put it, because he fought on its front lines. He was the perfect guide.
That's a wonderful way to think about it. A rare combination of, you know, deep philosophical engagement and real intellectual honesty. So let's unpack this map he created. The book Free Will, it's basically this meticulously curated anthology. Lots of seminal essays, key articles.
Right, the greatest hits, in a way.
It doesn't give you the answer, does it? It's more about equipping you, the reader, to grapple with it yourself. Agency, responsibility.
Think of it like an intellectual journey. It covers centuries. It takes you on this historical and thematic tour, which is really crucial.
Why historical first?
Well, you see how the ideas developed. It starts way back with the ancient Greeks, you know, Aristotle on voluntary action, the Stoics wrestling with fate, and a deterministic cosmos.
Already bumping up against this problem.
Absolutely. Then it moves through Enlightenment thinkers, reframing it with scientific laws versus human autonomy.
Okay, and then it gets to the modern stuff.
Right into the heart of the contemporary conflict. That's where the debate really sharpens. The book systematically lays out the three major camps. First, you've got compatibilism.
The ones who say free will and determinism can surprisingly coexist.
Yeah, that they're compatible. Then there's incompatibilism.
Which says, nope, pick one. You can't have both.
Exactly. And that camp splits in two. You have libertarianism, Kane's view, saying we do have free will, so determinism must be false. We have real choices.
Genuine, open possibilities.
Right. And on the other side, hard determinism, or free will skepticism. They agree it's incompatible, but they land on determinism being true.
So, no free will.
That's their conclusion. An illusion, perhaps.
Wow. And the book dives into all the tricky bits. Causation, freedom definitions.
Oh, yeah. moral responsibility, big arguments like the consequence argument, Frankfurt cases, even modern neuroscience like the Libet experiments.
Ones that seem to show decisions happen before we're aware.
Those ones. They definitely threw a wrench into the works.
And a key takeaway from the book is that this isn't just abstract navel-gazing.
Not at all. It emphasizes how this touches everything. Our legal systems, ethics, our personal sense of self, our identity. You come away with a much deeper appreciation for what's at stake.
And hopefully a better framework for thinking about your own freedom. Okay, let's dig into the core arguments. Part 1. The problem of free will and determinism. Historical roots.
This really sets the stage right, the fundamental clash.
Absolutely. It's that core tension, our gut feeling of freedom versus a universe that seems to run on cause and effect, like clockwork, almost.
And it shows this isn't new.
Far from it. You see Aristotle puzzling over voluntary action. Then the Stoics, with their idea of a deterministic cosmos governed by fate or logos, how does human agency fit that?
The question was there right from the start.
Then, the early modern period, especially with the rise of science, really reframed it. Thinkers like Hobbes, and especially David Hume.
Oh, Hume. He laid the groundwork for classical compatibilism.
That's right. Hume's definition of liberty is really key here. He argued liberty isn't freedom from causes acting on you.
But freedom from?
Freedom from coercion, from being forced. You're free, Hume said, if you can act according to your own desires, your own will, without external constraints, even if that will itself was caused.
That's a big shift in thinking. It is. And this historical grounding is so vital because it gives us the vocabulary determinism, freedom, responsibility that shapes the whole rest of the conversation.
Okay, so moving to part 2, compatibilist perspectives. This fleshes out that idea, freedom within determinism.
Right. This is probably the most popular view among philosophers today, or at least one of the main contenders. The core idea, free will is compatible with determinism.
Some even say determinism is needed for freedom. How does that work?
Well, the thought is, if your choices weren't determined by your character, your beliefs, your desires, if they were truly random, could you really be held responsible? Determinism, in this view, links your actions to you.
I see. It provides the connection.
Exactly. So classical compatibilism, like Hume's view, defines freedom as doing what you want to do. Your action is caused by your internal states, not external force.
But it gets more sophisticated.
It does. Yeah. Thinkers like Harry Frankfurt developed hierarchical compatibilism. It adds layers.
Layers of desire.
Kind of. Frankfurt said freedom isn't just acting on your desires, your first order desires, like wanting a coffee. It's about having the desires you want to have, your second order desires.
Okay, like the addict example in the outline.
Perfect example. The addict acts on their first order desire for the drug. But if they desperately wear they didn't have that desire, that's a second-order desire. Frankfurt says they aren't truly free because their higher-order will conflicts with their action.
So freedom is about alignment between what you do and what you fundamentally wish you wanted.
That's a big part of it. And Frankfurt famously argued you don't even need alternative possibilities for responsibility.
Those Frankfurt cases, how do they work again? Briefly.
Okay, quick version. Imagine a clever neuroscientist, Black, wants Jones to vote Democrat. Black plants a device that will force Jones to vote Democrat only if Jones starts to decide to vote Republican.
Okay.
But Jones, completely on his own, without the device ever activating, decides to vote Democrat anyway.
So he couldn't have done otherwise because Black was waiting.
Right. But did Jones act freely? Was he responsible? Frankfurt says yes, because the reason he voted Democrat was his own. The backup plan was irrelevant to his actual choice.
That really shifts the focus away from could have done otherwise.
It does. And then you have reason responsive views, like John Martin Fisher's. Freedom here is guidance control.
Guidance control.
Meaning your actions flow from a mechanism, your decision-making process that is responsive to reasons. Even if you couldn't have done otherwise in that moment, what matters is that your mechanism would have responded differently if the reasons had been different.
So it's about the nature of the process that led to the action.
Exactly. Was it a process sensitive to rational considerations? These compatibilist views really push us to define freedom less as raw alternatives and more as authorship, self-expression, rational control.
Okay, let's switch gears to part 3, incompatibilist perspectives. Here the gloves come off, right? Free will and determinism cannot coexist.
Absolutely. If one's true, the other's false. And a major weapon in their arsenal is Peter Van Inwagen's consequence argument.
You mentioned it's very logical. Walk us through it.
Okay, think about it. One, if determinism is true, then everything you do now is just the necessary consequence of.
The laws of nature in the distant past.
Exactly. Things that happened long before you were born.
Right.
Two, you can't change the laws of nature.
Right.
And you definitely can't change the past.
Seems pretty solid.
Three, therefore, you can't change the consequences of those things. Four, which means you can't change your own actions now.
So if determinism is true, no freedom to do otherwise, the conclusion seems hard to escape.
It's a powerful argument, and it leads directly to libertarianism, which is Robert Kane's camp. Libertarians hear that argument and say,
okay, the argument works, so determinism must be false because we do have free will.
That's the move.
Wow.
But then they face the big challenge. If our actions aren't determined, aren't they just random, chaotic? How are we in control?
Random, the problem.
Exactly. And this is where Kane's own view, event-causal libertarianism, comes in with his SFA's self-forming actions.
Right, those moments of deep conflict.
Yes. He suggests genuine freedom arises from indeterminacy, possibly in our neural processes, during these tough choices, like moral duty versus selfish ambition. You're genuinely torn.
And the indeterminacy means it could go either way.
Potentially. But Kane says your effort of will in that moment resolves the indeterminacy. It's your struggle, your effort, that tips the scales one way or the other. So it's not random you are the author because your effort made the difference. You are literally forming your character in that moment.
That's actually quite an appealing idea. Effort makes it yours.
It is. Then there's a more, let's say, metaphysically bold view, agent-causal libertarianism. Thinkers like Roderick Chisholm.
How does that differ?
Instead of the choice being caused by prior events plus some indeterminacy resolved by effort, agent causalists say the agent themselves, the person, directly causes the choice without being caused by anything else.
Like the agent is a prime mover, starting a new causal chain.
That's the idea. A bit more mysterious for some, perhaps, but it aims for ultimate sourcehood.
Okay. And the other side of incompatibilism.
That's hard determinism or free will skepticism. Thinkers like Dirk Paraboom, Galen Strawson, they agree with the incompatibilists. Free will and determinism don't mix.
But they draw the opposite conclusion.
Right. They think determinism is likely true, or at least that indeterminism doesn't help give us the kind of control needed for free will. So they conclude, no free will.
Galen Strawson's basic argument sounds particularly challenging.
It is. It's a regress argument. Strawson basically says, look, to be truly morally responsible for what you do, you'd have to be truly responsible for how you are, mentally speaking, your character, your motivations, etc.
Okay, that seems plausible.
But to be responsible for how you are, you'd have to have chosen to be that way. But to make that choice responsibly, you'd already need to have certain principles or preferences guiding that choice.
And you'd have to be responsible for those principles.
Exactly. It goes back and back. You can't create yourself from nothing ex nihilo. You didn't choose your genes, your early environment. So Strawson argues, you can't be ultimately responsible for the actions that flow from the character you inevitably developed.
Wow. That really pulls the rug out.
It's meant to. This part of the book really forces you to confront the deep challenges to our intuitive sense of freedom and responsibility.
Which leads us nicely into part four, modern challenges and new directions. Science enters the picture here big time.
Right. Especially neuroscience and free will. The Libet experiments are probably the most famous example.
Remind us briefly.
Benjamin Libet found brain signals, this readiness potential, that seemed to build up before people reported consciously deciding to make a simple movement, like flexing their wrist, hundreds of milliseconds before.
Which many people interpreted as.
As proof that our conscious decision is just a spectator. The brain's already decided unconsciously, and the feeling of I decided now comes later, like a rationalization after the fact.
A major blow to the idea of conscious will being in charge.
It certainly seemed that way, and the book explores the fallout. But it also covers the rebuttals. Philosophers jumped in quickly.
What were the main criticisms?
Well, is flexing your finger really representative of complex free will? Like deciding who to marry or whether to take a job? Probably not. And what does the readiness potential actually signify? Maybe it's just the brain preparing for a possible action, not the commitment to the action. The jury is still very much out.
And other neuroscience. Split brain studies.
Yeah, Michael Gazzaniga's work suggested a left brain interpreter that constantly creates stories to make sense of our actions, even actions initiated by other parts of the brain unconsciously. Again, making conscious control seem less unified, less direct than we feel.
This all points towards a really critical question the book tackles. What about moral responsibility without free will? If the skeptics are right, what happens then?
It's a huge practical question. Peerboom, for example, argues we need to ditch retributive justice. Punishing people because they deserve it doesn't make sense if they didn't have free will.
So what's the alternative?
Focus on pragmatic goals. Deterrence, preventing future harm, rehabilitation. Think more like how we handle quarantine for infectious diseases. It's about public safety, not blame. Like the Norwegian prison system, perhaps.
But not everyone agrees we'd have to abandon responsibility practices.
Right. P.F. Strawson Galen's father actually had a very influential argument. He talked about our reactive attitudes.
Like resentment, gratitude.
Exactly. Love, forgiveness, indignation. These are deeply ingrained human responses to how people treat us. Strawson argued these attitudes and the practices of holding people responsible that go with them are so fundamental to our humanity, to our relationships, that the abstract philosophical truth about determinism is almost irrelevant to them. We couldn't, and maybe shouldn't, give them up.
So, even if determinism is true, we'd still feel resentment if wronged.
His argument suggests yes, these feelings are just too core to who we are. This whole section really drags the ancient debate into the 21st century, forcing us to connect philosophy with science and rethink our basic social structures.
Okay, let's try to pull some threads together. What are the main themes or messages emerging from this deep dive?
Well, first, clearly the dilemma of determinism itself, that fundamental clash between a scientific cause and effect world and our powerful intuition of being free agents. Every theory is trying to solve that.
And central to solving it is defining freedom.
Exactly. The meaning of freedom. Two competing visions. Is freedom just being free from constraint, free to act on your desires, like compatibilists say? Or does it require something deeper, genuine, open possibilities being the ultimate source of your actions, like incompatibilists demand? So much hinges on that definition.
And the stakes are incredibly high because of moral responsibility.
That's the core stake, really. Why do we praise, blame, punish? Does responsibility absolutely need the ability to do otherwise? Or is it enough that your actions reflect your character, your values, your reasons?
Then there's a challenge for libertarians. Luck and randomness.
Right. If actions aren't determined, how are they not just random flukes? Keynes' SFAs are a specific attempt to answer this, saying the effort resolves the indeterminacy, making it non-randomly yours. It turns luck into self-creation.
We also saw the impact of science, especially neuroscience like Libet's work, really reshaping the debate, forcing philosophers to grapple with empirical findings.
It adds a whole new dimension, doesn't it? And finally, the really profound practical implication. Rethinking justice and punishment. The possibility that retributive justice might be based on an illusion, pushing us towards more pragmatic, maybe more humane, approaches like rehabilitation.
These are huge ideas. The book must contain some powerful, quotable lines that capture these positions.
Absolutely. We can maybe summarize the core stances. For the compatibilist, the idea is something like, freedom isn't the absence of causes, it's the absence of coercion. You're free when your actions flow from your own will, your beliefs, desires, without being forced.
So freedom within the causal flow.
Precisely. Then for the libertarian, think of Keynes' principle of ultimate responsibility. You are. To be ultimately responsible, you must be responsible for the ultimate reasons or motives for your action. This means some actions, your self-forming actions, must be undetermined, so you are the source.
You have to be the anchor, not just a link in the chain.
That's the intuition. Then the skeptic's basic argument, maybe Galen Strawson's version, you can't be the cause of yourself. To be truly responsible, you'd have to be the cause of your own character in key ways. Since that's impossible, true moral responsibility is impossible.
The regress problem again. You can't create your own starting point.
Exactly. And finally, Frankfurt's huge challenge to alternative possibilities. You can be morally responsible even if you couldn't have done otherwise. What matters isn't the paths not taken, but the path you did take and why.
Focusing on the actual sequence, the actual reasons.
Right. That thought experiment really forced everyone to reconsider what responsibility truly requires. It suggested the source of the action within the agent might matter more than hypothetical alternatives.
These aren't just philosophical chess moves, though. They connect to real life, don't they?
Absolutely. Take criminal justice reform. If you lean towards determinism or skepticism, you might strongly favor rehabilitative models over purely punitive ones. Think Norway versus perhaps more retributive systems. It forces you to ask, what is the goal of our justice system if free will is limited or non-existent?
And on a personal level, personal growth.
K. Kane's SFAs offer a powerful lens here. Those moments of struggle, overcoming a bad habit, pushing through a difficult project, aren't just obstacles. They are opportunities for genuine self-creation. It makes you view those struggles differently, doesn't it? As chances to define who you are.
Yeah, it reframes effort itself. What about relationships and forgiveness?
A skeptical perspective might foster more empathy. If someone hurts you, understanding the complex web of causes behind their actions, upbringing, biology, circumstances, doesn't excuse the harm, but it might temper raw anger. It could shift the focus to problem solving or setting boundaries rather than just blame. How does your belief here affect how you react?
That's a really practical connection. And mental health.
Understanding limits on conscious control can reduce toxic self-blame and shame. If you struggle with anxiety or depression, realizing it's not just a failure of willpower can promote self-compassion. Therapy often helps uncover those deeper influences, empowering you without demanding you be fully responsible for the origins of the struggle.
And lastly, social policy and inequality.
Big implications here. If success isn't solely down to individual grit and free choices, but heavily influenced by factors beyond our control, genetics, background, luck, opportunity, then doesn't society have a stronger obligation to level the playing field? Think universal healthcare, quality education. It challenges the idea that everyone just gets what they freely chose or earned. Does this debate make you reconsider the roots of success and failure?
It definitely does. For me, what really stood out from this deep dive is, well, just how complex it all is. There are no easy answers. And the intellectual honesty needed to really sit with all the arguments, even the ones that feel uncomfortable, is immense. It hammered home the stakes, how these abstract-seeming beliefs profoundly shape our gut feelings, our laws, everything. We take our sense of freedom so much for granted.
Yeah, that honesty is key. What I loved is how the book and Kane's curation sharpens your understanding of freedom itself.
Yeah.
You go from this vague feeling to dissecting precise concepts. Freedom as rational control versus freedom as open alternatives versus freedom as ultimate sourcehood. It gives you the tools to think clearly about what you mean by freedom. And, you know, the inquiry isn't over. It's ongoing. Just engaging with these ideas, wrestling with them, that makes for a more examined life, doesn't it? The real question left for you, the listener, might be, when you face those moments of choice or reflect on responsibility, which understanding of freedom resonates most deeply with you now?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.